From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. July 4th is a time to celebrate Americana, one of America's unique musical styles as Tex-Mex, border rock and roll. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from two members of the all-star Tex-Mex group, the Texas Tornadoes. Singer Freddie Fender, one of the few Chicano singers who's topped the country music charts, and organist Augie Myers. Also, if you're drinking beer with your holiday barbecue, you'll be interested in what Michael Jackson has to say. He's one of the world's leading experts on the brew. On the other hand, if you're not having a barbecue, you'll be interested in what Ed Ward has to say. He's not having a barbecue either. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. It's been announced that Lebanese and Palestinian leaders have reached an agreement on ending the fighting around Palestinian refugee camps near Sidon in southern Lebanon. Battles between Lebanese army troops and Palestinian guerrillas have left about 60 people dead and many more wounded. Jim Muir reports.
A special Lebanese government committee composed of two ministers held more than 4 hours of talks with Palestinian guerrilla leaders in Sidon. The two sides later said they'd agreed that the Lebanese army would complete its planned deployment around the Palestinian camps, with the guerrillas pulling their remaining fighters back inside. The Palestinians also agreed to collect up their heavy weapons and remove them from the camps under army supervision, in order, they said, not to give Israel any pretext for attacking them. So the Palestinians have essentially given way to the Lebanese government. But they also got what they earlier said they wanted, a dialogue with the government on defining the rights of the Palestinians living in Lebanon. Lebanese government ministers say that once the Sidon area is quiet, they'll start pressing for Israel to give up its nearby security zone in southern Lebanon. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia.
Yugoslavia's prime minister denied today that he ordered the army to use force in the secessionist Republic of Slovenia. Ante Markovic said the army was out of control. He said that command of the army belonged to Yugoslavia's collective federal presidency, which is now meeting in an effort to reestablish control over the military. There may be a new nation added to the world map in 2 years, a nation called Eritrea. Political leaders forming a new government in Ethiopia voted today to let citizens of the northern province decide if they want to be independent. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
Eritrean rebels have been fighting Ethiopia's central government for 30 years for the right to make their province an independent nation. It's been the longest civil war on the continent. As of today, they've won their wish. Leaders of 24 Ethiopian rebel and political groups have been meeting this week to set up a new government in Addis Ababa to replace the Soviet-backed government overthrown 6 weeks ago. And they voted this evening to let the 4 million residents of Eritrea hold a UN-sponsored referendum on independence 2 years from now. The chief architects of the new government hope that Eritreans will eventually decide to stay part of the country, but they say it's the democratic and pragmatic thing to do to let them secede if that's what they really want. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Addis Ababa.
Police in Peru claim that Maoist guerrillas are behind attacks that have killed at least 14 people in the Andes Mountains this week. The police say that guerrillas from the Shining Path movement attacked government agriculture officials and police in a small mountain town. Officials claim that the rebels are trying to block rural development projects and destroy the economy. This is NPR News. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said today that Israel needs a substantial boost in U.S. military aid to help it keep its weapons superiority over its Arab neighbors. Israel now receives $1.8 billion a year in U.S. military aid. Aaron said that the value of that aid has been eroded over the years, and Israel needs an increase of almost 40% to catch up. In Chicago, the public schools superintendent is suggesting that a number of schools be closed to help reduce a projected budget deficit of $250 million. Officials had been hoping state lawmakers would come to their aid, but the Illinois legislature is grappling with budget problems of its own. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
Chicago School Superintendent Ted Kimbrough is recommending that 19 schools in Chicago be closed and that several others be consolidated. The proposal could save $26 million. Attempts to get state lawmakers to help rid the school system of a huge deficit have largely been ignored. Illinois faces a massive deficit of its own, and state lawmakers still have not crafted a budget. Even so, Superintendent Kimbrough says for the sake of the schools, lawmakers must take action.
The legislature is having a very difficult time in reaching a decision on their budget. And I thought that it would be a good time to remind them that there are a lot of major entities here in the public sector that need to have that question answered.
Meanwhile, education activists say they will fight the proposed school closings. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
The Miami Herald reported today that a high-ranking immigration official is under investigation for allegedly accepting bribes to provide illegal aliens with permanent residency cards. Federal court papers indicate that Luis Del Rio is accused of accepting $5,000 bribes from Chinese, Colombian, and Venezuelan nationals. The government hasn't filed any charges. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Texas has a special place in the history of rock and roll. It's the home of Tex-Mex, border music that combines the influences of Mexican music and rock and roll. And several of the finest Tex-Mex players have united in an all-star band called the Texas Tornadoes. They're touring this summer. The band features Doug Somm on piano and vocals, Freddie Fender on vocals and guitar, Flaco Jimenez on accordion, and Augie Myers on organ and accordion. Two of the Texas Tornadoes are my guests. Augie Myers' rhythmic, pumping organ style has influenced many other rockers. We'll meet him later in the show. First, a talk with Freddie Fender. He's best known for his country hits of the mid-70s, Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, and Before the Next Teardrop Falls. Fender is a Chicano, and in the 1950s he had many regional hits, several of which were recorded in Spanish. From the Texas Tornadoes album, this is Freddie Fender singing a song he co-wrote called A Man Can Cry.
A man can cry. A love can surely die. They're not here to stay. The sunshine and the rain. Let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby. The towering mountain high is to prove my love. Of this love have I. But let me, oh, oh, let me tell you, baby, I'm still in love with you.
Freddie Fender singing with the new Texas Tornadoes from their new album. It seems to me you really like to sing ballads the best, and I find that interesting since your early stuff was really heavy on the rhythm and blues. Has there been a musical change, or is that just what you think sells best?
See, there's some songs that we're doing now that are ballads, but they have a lot of oomph in
right.
it, a lot of rock in the ballads. I like a ballad with a lot of triplet piano behind me and a strong drummer, a strong bass, and really good fill-in with the guitars, you know? So that's what I like. I like a slow rhythm of blues with a lot of rock background on it.
How did you start performing?
I started performing at radio stations. We had a little station called KGBS in Harlingen and San Benito, Texas, and we happened to know the DJ. This was 1946, 47. I was 9 or 10 years old. And I'd go over there with a guitar, and it was a big kick for him to see a little kid with a guitar singing.
I know that one of the records you made in the 1950s was a cover recording in Spanish of Elvis Presley's Don't Be Cruel. Whose idea was it to do that in Spanish? Was it your idea to do that?
In a way, I think that I gave the idea to the producer of the session that I did. I was Don't Be Cruel in Spanish and some other songs, the Elvis Presley hits, because at that time, we did not have Elvis Presley imitators. Everybody wanted to imitate Elvis Presley, whether you sang or not.
Was your image the Hispanic Elvis at the time?
Very much so. I was called a bebop kid and the Mexican Elvis Presley, believe it or not.
When did you change your name from Baldomar Huerta to Freddy Fender? Why did you change it?
Well, Wayne Duncan, who became my first manager, had a jukebox route. That's about as close as he was to the record business. And he said, I'm going to record you, and you're going to have to get a name where you can look at the jukebox, you'll put a nickel in it. And in other words, not Baldomar Huerta, you know? So I said, well, let me pick a name. So I picked Fender from the guitar and the amplifier, and Freddie just out of the air. Luckily, if you put a Y on Freddie instead of an IE, you will have the same amount of letters on it, which helps a lot when you print it on an album or something. You know, it comes out just right.
Let's go back to 1959 and your recording of Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. Now, you later recorded this in the mid-70s, and it was a big hit. But this is your first recording of it back in 1959.
Wasted days and wasted nights. Why should I keep loving you when I know that you're not true? And why should I...
Freddy Fender recorded in 1959. Not too long after this record was made, you were busted at a club for, what, holding three joints?
I wasn't holding anything, no.
Oh, okay. Well, what was the story?
They found it in the apartment where I lived. They found some, maybe a couple of joints or something like that, and that was the end of that one, you know.
How long did you spend in prison for that?
2.5 years.
Were you able to keep playing while you were in prison, playing music?
Oh, yes, yeah. I kept up with my guitar and played music.
Is it right that you were paroled under the condition that you didn't get back into music?
Not really. I was paroled on the condition that I wouldn't be anywhere where they serve liquor and anywhere they play music except for church. Even in church, they serve wine. So I might as well, you know, just seal it up.
I see. So it wasn't that the judge... It wasn't so much that you weren't supposed to play music. It was that you weren't supposed to be around alcohol.
Yeah.
But what effect did that have on your music career?
I still went ahead and played and got away pretty good, you know.
Where'd you play, though, if you couldn't play at places that served alcohol?
Usually beer joints that didn't advertise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I wouldn't play any public places. I'd just go to beer joints, little hell holes, you know, and nobody would know about it except the people that went there every day.
Well, that's not the best way to get discovered, is it?
No, I was young. I wasn't really thinking that much about discovery. As a matter of fact, my whole life, I have never expected anything, you know. I've just played music, that's all, you know. And if it happens, it happens. If it don't happen, well, hell, I'm still playing, you know. I was shooting for success and waiting for failure without being afraid of failure. Now I fear failure just tremendously. I've gone to the other side now, you know. If I fail, man, I'm going to be real hurt because I know what success is now, and I want it,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, in the mid-70s, you had a lot of success with several hits that were especially big on the country charts. I'm thinking of Before the Next Teardrop Falls and your re-recording of Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. You made these records with Huey P. Moe producing you. How did the two of you team up?
Huey who? Never heard of him, Terry. We did some...
Are you on the outs now or something with him?
Yes, and I really don't like to talk to him, you know, with all due respect. Let's put it like this. I pray for him every night. Okay?
Okay, we can
bad business, bad business transactions, okay? And it just bothers me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, God bless him.
Your songs, I think, were especially big in country music. How did you end up crossing over into country?
It was a project that came from that person we were talking about. From Number Five. Number Five said, Freddie, I got a song for you, and we're going to record it. I want you to record it. I said, I don't want to record it. I don't record country music. I'm a rhythm and blues guy, and I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, look, we were recording an R&B album. You're not going to get back to the R&B album you're doing until you finish this. And they played it for me, and I learned the words. And in 20 minutes, I had put it down in English and Spanish, and it was the original. Without, it didn't have the accordion at that time. The music was there already. They just added the accordion later on, and that was, I think it's all about $3 million.
Was it hard in any way to get accepted in country music? Are there ways that you always felt like an outsider?
I think that before they knew what was going on, my song was number one. It was too late. I don't think they had a choice on whether they should accept me into their society or not. And before they knew it, my song was number one, not only in country, but in pop. And then after that, for better or for worse, they all know Freddie Fender now.
I've been speaking with Freddie Fender, and he's one of the members of the new group Texas Tornadoes, along with Doug Sam and Flaco Jimenez. And Augie Myers, who's featured on both accordion and organ on this new album, is with me as well. And I'll be speaking with him after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. With me now is Augie Myers, and he's featured on the new Texas Tornadoes album. And Augie Myers for years played organ with the Sir Douglas Quintet, and he plays organ and accordion on the new album. And just to give you a sense of this terrific organ playing, let's listen to What Were You Thinking Of from the new Texas Tornadoes album. My guest, Augie Myers, featured on both accordion and organ on that recording. You overdubbing on that?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to. you really use organ as a rhythm instrument. I was wondering how you started playing organ that way.
I don't know, my main instrument, I guess, years ago was piano, and that was the first Vox organ that was ever in America I bought in 1962. And I didn't like the way it sounded trying to play solos on it, so I just started playing rhythm on it, just used it as a rhythm instrument.
I think a lot of people picked up on that. Who did you have anybody to pick up on? I mean, had you heard organ played that way before?
No, nowhere. I listened to, I guess my piano players way back then was Moon Mulligan and then Ray Charles. A lot of people don't know Ray Charles played with Guitar Slim. He was called R.C. Richardson way back then. And he mostly played a lot of shuffle stuff, and it was mostly rhythm. Piano was mainly used as a rhythm instrument way back in the blues era. And that's what I mainly play his rhythm.
I'm trying to remember what year 96 Tears was made, because that also had great organ as rhythm.
Well, those people used to sit back and listen to me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you influenced the people who made that record.
And, no, well, they listened to us play and asked me. I programmed the 96 Tears organ thing for them, how to get the tone that they wanted on the record.
Oh, really? You play Vox and Hammond B3 on the new record.
Right.
What's the difference between the two and what you can get out of it?
Oh, a lot. I mean, no, a Hammond B3 is, you know, it's like a milkshake, you know, with whipped cream and ice cream. And a Vox organ is just a glass of water, but a good glass of water. So there's a lot of difference between that. I mean, you got more sounds out of the Hammond organ for rhythm and blues and jazz and stuff, where Vox was mainly used for a lot of the English stuff.
This is one of those little organs that kind of stand up?
Right.
Like a small keyboard?
Right.
So you were the first person in the States to have a Vox organ?
Right.
How did you become the first person to do that?
I used to prescribe to a lot of English magazines back in the early 60s just to check up and see what's going on. And I remember it was $285, and a man, God bless him, he's gone now, but he owned a music store in San Antonio named Mr. Woods. He helped me get it. It was $285. Then after the Beatles and the Stones and Dave Clark Five and everybody came out, they ran up to like $1,500. I still have my original one. I've got four of them. And if anybody out there has got one, want to sell it, please let me know. I like to buy them all.
Oh, really? So did this make you in demand, having this new sound and new instrument?
For a fact, yes, it did. And I remember when me and Doug first went to England in the 60s, George Harrison and John Lennon, called a hotel and wanted me to come to the studio because they wanted to see how they had a Vox organ, but they couldn't get the sound that I had out of mine. They couldn't get their sound out of theirs. But it was only due to the amplification. They didn't have reverb in their amplifiers back then. The reverb was a new thing that came out.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you had polio as a child.
Yeah, from when I was 2 years old till I was almost 10, I had polio. I couldn't walk.
So you didn't start walking until you were around 10?
Until I was about 10. So I lived with my grandparents, and when they used to go out in the field every day and pick cotton, they took me over to this black lady's house, and her husband picked cotton for my grandfolks, and they had a piano, and he played in their church, in the black church. But they used to set me up on a piano just to pacify my time away all day, and that's what I did because there was no TV back then. They didn't have radio or electricity in the house.
Were your hands and fingers strong enough to play?
Well, my right one was. My left one was a little affected by the polio, but my grandfather, I owe it all to him. He made me walk again, plus the good Lord, you know. But my grandfather, he did his home remedies on me.
So do you think learning to play when one hand was still weak affected the way you ended up playing, you know, the style that you ended up having?
Well, I think so because I do a lot of rhythm on my right hand, and my left hand just kind of hits you know, the dominant chord on there. I still have problem. I do therapy. I play. That's why I bought my accordion for therapy and for my hands and my fingers, and I learned to play guitar that way too.
Did you get full strength back in your hands?
Well, put it this way, I appreciate what I got. If I got it, if I had any more, I don't know what I'd do with it.
One of the like great rock and roll stories was how when you were produced by Uwe Moe, how he wanted to pass you off as a British invasion group.
Who?
Yeah, do you feel that way also? Are you into the Who?
No. Freddie just looked at me and said Who. I just said Who.
Okay.
Huey wanted to pass, but I mean it was really hard because there was two gringos and three Mexicans in a band, you know, and trying to get these Spanish dudes to sit there and try to, you know, I like a spot of tea, you know, and try to talk English when they'd sit there and say, "Hey, what the man? What time is it, man? Let's go get a beer," you know, and that was their kind of accent, you know. So trying to be English. It pulled it off till Trini Lopez on, I think it was Holla Blue, said, "Man, they're from Texas," you know.
Augie Myers is my guest, and he plays organ and accordion on the new Texas Tornadoes album. Well, what is your ethnic group? What's your ethnic background?
Gemini.
So am I.
Ready, Gemini, too. No, what do you mean my ethnic background?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, you're a gringo playing a lot of you know, Tex-Mex, Mexican-inspired music. So, I wasn't sure what your ethnic background is.
I'm a German and Polish.
German and Polish. Okay.
Yes.
So, you probably heard the music of a lot of different ethnic groups growing up in Texas.
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, why don't I play something that's kind of half Spanish? This is a song that you wrote called Hey Baby, ¿Qué Pasó? Do you want to say anything about the song and about...
Well, I mean, as a, I wanted to write something that was, you know, at one point nobody would play my records back home because I either had a, the country station wouldn't play it, it had horns on it. The rock station wouldn't play it because I had a fiddle or steel. The Spanish station wouldn't play it because there was no Spanish in it. So I just did the Que Paso, you know, to half English, half Spanish, put a little accordion in it. Actually, I wrote that song about one of my girlfriends running off with my best friends.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I miss him, too, because we used to go out and shoot pool and drink beer.
Well, this is the version of it from the new Texas Tornadoes record, and it features Augie Myers on vocals, accordion, and organ. Freddie Fender is on electric guitar, and here we go.
You can hear him yelling in the background, too.
Okay.
Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Thought I was your only vato. Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Please don't leave me this and mozo. Come on, baby, turn around. Let me see your pretty blue eyes. Don't you know that I love you? Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Thought I was your only vato. Hey, baby, ¿qué pasó? Won't you give me un beso?
Augie Myers on organ, accordion, and vocals, and the aforementioned Freddie Fender yelling in the background there.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you both now, Freddie Fender and Augie Myers, is this Texas Tornadoes group exposing you to different audiences than you're used to because of the conglomeration of people on it and the way the tours are being booked?
I think it's exposing Freddie to a whole new audience more. Because, I mean, we're playing to the same kind of audiences. Am I right, Freddie, you think so?
Yes, well, being considered a country artist only for so many years.
Country crooner.
Country crooner, romantic crooner. Now, for the first time, I'm gigging with these guys, and I'm playing guitar. I'm picking some blues and some hot, funky stuff that I hadn't done in years, like I told you. You know, I started out with that kind of music. Then I went into country, and it seemed like I couldn't get out of it because all my bookings were country audiences. But when I got in with the Tornadoes, now I'm getting the bookings. 99.9% of the bookings are bookings that Augie and Doug were doing before, and now I'm doing. But we're playing some real raunchy rock and roll places, man.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us, and I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry.
Augie Myers is the organist with the Texas Tornadoes. Earlier, we heard from Freddie Fender, who sings with the band. The band has a record called Texas Tornadoes. They'll perform in Chicago on July 21st and in Santa Rosa on the 25th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If you got the dinero, oh, I got my Camaro. Just flash some cash, buy some gas. Bring all of your pesos, I'll supply all the basil. Buy some cerveza, ride up the mesa, watch the sun go down. If you got the dinero, oh, I got my Camaro.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When British journalist Michael Jackson was a young reporter, he and his colleagues liked their beer. They drank it, they talked about it, and they wanted to write about it, but they figured no one would care. Now Jackson travels the world, tasting the best brews and writing about it. Coming up, we talk beer and scotch with the guru of the grain, Michael Jackson. Also on this holiday when everybody is supposed to be flipping burgers on the barbecue, our rock historian Ed Ward is not. Ed tells us why he doesn't like to barbecue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, that country's eight-man collective leadership met in Belgrade in another effort to find a peaceful way out of the current crisis that has brought the country to the verge of all-out civil war. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The Federal Army, 2 days after appearing to move out of civilian control, today obeyed the presidency's orders and kept quiet. Federal troops are avoiding clashes with Slovene troops, and the Slovenes are doing the same. But the leadership of the Slovene Republic today defied the presidency's demand that it turn over control of border posts to federal authorities. The Slovene government, which a week ago declared its independence from Yugoslavia, insisted it could not take back what it has already done. The question now, then, is whether the army will remain in its barracks if it concludes the Slovene government is not keeping its end of the ceasefire bargain proposed by the federal presidency. Also unresolved is the future of Croatia. Ethnic Serbs in Croatian territory have armed themselves and are preparing for war with Croatian police forces. The army has positioned itself between the two sides, but Croatian officials suspect the army of supporting the Serbs. I'm Tom Gelton in Zagreb.
In New York City, UN officials have announced that another UN inspection team will travel to Iraq to try to find out if the Iraqi government is complying with terms of a UN ceasefire. One of the conditions of this ceasefire is that Iraq eliminate all of its weapons of mass destruction. Christopher Powell of the BBC reports from Geneva.
This will be the third United Nations inspection team to visit Iraq. The two previous ones have had a mixed reception. Access has been denied to some sites suspected of housing either weapons facilities or nuclear material. And there have also been instances of the physical intimidation of the teams of inspectors. However, it's clear the pressure on Iraq will be maintained. Ambassador Akers described the inspections as part of a continuing process. He said work to dismantle ballistic missiles with a range over 150 kilometers had begun as scheduled. Iraq has declared 60 such missiles to the UN, but it's not known yet how many have been destroyed. The ambassador was also unable to say if the new team would be granted greater access than his own commission had been, and neither would he say if the physical safety of the inspectors had been guaranteed by the Iraqi authorities.
Christopher Powell of the BBC reporting from Geneva. A French oil company has signed an agreement to build a $440 million oil refinery in northern China. This facility is scheduled to open in the second half of 1994 and aim its products at markets in the Far East. The stock market was closed today because of the 4th of July holiday, but in Tokyo, stock prices fell for the third day in a row. This is National Public Radio News. In Lebanon, the PLO and the government have ended their fighting and agreed to allow the Lebanese army to impose government authority in the southern part of the country. Earlier this week, PLO guerrillas had blocked the army taking over its main strongholds, touching off battles in which at least 65 people were killed and over 100 others were wounded. The PLO has also agreed to send all of its heavy weapons out of the country. Speaking today at ceremonies to commission the Navy's latest ship, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney said that despite the end of the Cold War and cutbacks in the U.S. military, the U.S. is still committed to quality in the armed forces. Gail Converse of member station WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia, reports.
The USS Arleigh Burke, the Navy's newest destroyer, served as a backdrop along the Norfolk waterfront for Dick Cheney's speech. The defense secretary said America needs robust naval power.
The fact is, the United States is a maritime nation. We must cross the oceans to reach virtually all of our allies and trading partners. Our defense against aggression and our ability to foster freedom in the world depend on America's maritime capabilities.
Cheney said he couldn't think of a better way to celebrate this 4th of July than to commission a ship designed to be the leading edge of tomorrow's force for freedom around the world. For National Public Radio, this is Gail Converse in Norfolk, Virginia.
The Conference Board says that business continued to trim hiring in May in spite of some encouraging economic studies. The Business Research Group says its findings are evidence that the jobless picture is continuing to be hurt by widespread layoffs. The board said that its seasonally adjusted Help Wanted advertising index slipped another point in May and was 40 points below May of a year ago. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of Americans are drinking beer with their barbecue this holiday weekend. My guest Michael Jackson is considered by many to be the world's leading consumer writer on beer. And I suppose he doesn't have all that much competition. Many connoisseurs write seriously about wine, few about beer. Jackson's books include The New World Guide to Beer and The Pocket Guide to Beer. He's also written a couple of books about single malt scotch. And he did a TV series called The Beer Hunter that was shown on the Discovery Channel. Beer drinkers in America are becoming more discriminating. Imports are increasingly popular, as are American regional beers from the new microbreweries. And this makes Michael Jackson very happy.
I'm an unapologetic beer snob. I'm not a snob in other aspects of life. Perhaps I'm almost an inverted snob, you know, that I tend to go for the things that are perhaps not given the respect that they should be, and that's perhaps one of the things that attracted me to beer in the first place. There is an extraordinary diversity of beer available in the United States now. In fact, in some American cities, there's a bigger diversity of beer available than there is in any European city. I'm thinking particularly of Seattle, which is becoming very famous for its beer, but you could say that of Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco, too.
Why do you think this upscaling of beer is happening?
Well, the actual movement, I mean, there is a renaissance of serious interest in beer, and that can quite clearly be defined as having started in Britain in 1971. A group of people who fortunately happened to be journalists were complaining to each other on vacation about how beer was becoming more and more bland and more standardized, and they said, you know, we really should start a campaign for real ale, because ale is the type of beer that's principally drunk in Britain. They started that campaign, and it really took off, quite astonished them. They thought this was something fairly lighthearted, and it became a major national campaign. And a part of the one of the consequences of that was that a number of people began to start small breweries, and this was really the first time since perhaps before the First World War that anybody in any Western country had really been starting breweries. Breweries had been things that closed, and suddenly there were things that opened. I think if you look at it more broadly, it's you can see this in any kind of consumer product. You can see it in bread, cheese, coffee, pastas, that in a way perhaps mass marketing has reached its peak, and at its peak has made people perhaps yearn for more diversity, more traditional products, I think.
I think I'm typical of a lot of Americans in the sense that I drink my share of beer, but I know very little about how it's made. And it's really easy for me to visualize the making of wine, even though I know very little about that, too, because, you make the grapes into a liquid and they ferment, but I don't understand how beer is made out of malt. I mean, I've really never understood
that.
I don't mean malt. I mean barley.
Well, let's see what we do mean. I mean,
what do we mean?
The two are very, very. Wine and beer are made by very, very similar processes. They are.
But you don't step on barley.
Well, you can if you want to, but it doesn't do you an awful lot of good. I mean, really, wine is a less sophisticated product because you can just step on the grapes and get the juice out of them, and the juice will ferment. As a result of the wild yeast that was on the skins, and then you'll have your wine. And your winemaker then tells you, if you don't like it, well, tough, it wasn't a very good year, you know, which brewers never tell you. What beer is made out of grain. I mean, wine is made out of fruit, and the fruit is usually the grape.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be. Beer is made out of grain, and the grain is usually barley, but it doesn't have to be. Other grains are used to some extent, especially wheat. In order to get the natural fermentable sugars out of the grape, all you have to do is crush it. In order to get the natural fermentable sugars out of the grain, you have to soak it in water so that it begins to sprout. and then let it sprout for about a week. And at that point, that the sprouting of it is at the optimum, and you want to then stabilize it. So you stabilize it by heat. And that process, the process of taking grains, sprouting them, and arresting the sprouting by drying, is the process of malting. So when you've done that to barley, you've got barley malt. When you've done it to wheat, you've got wheat malt. We just usually just call it malt. Malt is the real, what grapes are to wine, barley malt or wheat malt is to beer.
In preparing for the interview with you, I found all these beer commercials and their lyrics going through my head, like brewed with pride and just a kiss of the hops, you know. It's like, you listen to all this as a kid and wonder, what is it?
A kiss of the hops is quite a nice way of putting it, really. I suspect I probably said that in something I've written, because they are there. The hops are there as a seasoning, and it's very much like if you were making, say, espresso coffee, cappuccino, and you put a little bit of chocolate on top of the foam, just a little kiss of chocolate. Uh-huh. It's just there as a last little finishing seasoning to balance the flavors out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jackson, who is considered by many to be the world's leading expert and writer about beer. And his books include The Pocket Guide to Beer, The New World Guide to Beer. Now he's also an expert on scotch, and he's the author of Michael Jackson's Complete Guide to Single Malt Scotch. Have you drunk a lot of light beer?
No, I haven't, and I don't really see any reason for drinking light beer. No beer will make anybody thin. You cannot lose weight by drinking beer. Some people, and I have this problem myself, are very susceptible to putting on weight by drinking beer. Other people, it depends on your metabolism, other people seem to be able to drink quite a lot of beer without putting on weight. The lady I attempt to share my life with is very, very slim indeed, and used to work in the fashion industry, and she likes to drink Guinness by the pint. And if I do that, you know, just from looking at the Guinness, I've already put a pound on, and she doesn't seem to. But nobody ever lost weight by drinking beer. So if you're worried about your weight, the best thing to do is drink less beer and maybe drink better beer.
Well, why not drink light beer? It does seem to, as advertised, have fewer calories.
Well, light beer is really scarcely worthy of the name beer. I mean, it's beer with water added. Why not just get regular beer and add water if you want to do that? But then why on earth would you want to do that? And whenever I see people drinking light beer, they're usually filling their face with nacho chips anyway. You know, there are more calories in a nacho chip than there are in a glass of beer. Also, the difference in calories between light beers and regular beers is really not very great. You know, you're talking about sort of something in the 90s in terms of calories with a light beer and something in the lower hundreds with a regular beer. It's really not worth, it's not worth doing that. All you're going to do is drink more of the beer. The beer's not very good. Why not just drink less beer and drink good beer?
How about, or drink wine? I mean, does wine have a lot fewer calories than beer does?
Wine does have fewer calories than beer, and I like wine very much as well. I mean, all of my books are about beer and whiskey and single malt scotches. The Manchester Guardian came out with a very nice line when they said, other writers on drink write about the grape. Michael Jackson's the guru of the grain, and I thought that was a very nice way of putting it. So those are my passions. My passions are beer and single malt scotches, but I still enjoy wine, and I don't see wine as the enemy. I'm looking for equal time for beer, I think.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jackson, who writes about beer. He's the author of The Pocket Guide to Beer, The New World Guide to Beer. He's considered perhaps the world's leading expert on beer. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Michael Jackson is my guest, and we're talking about what is probably his favorite subject, which is beer. Let's talk about single malt scotches, which is another big subject of yours. What's the difference between a blended whiskey, a blended scotch,
right,
and a single malt scotch?
Well, if you buy any of the well-known blended whiskies, I mean, Dewar's, J&B, Ballantine's, all of the well-known ones, Johnny Walker, are all blends. What you get in that bottle is really an astonishingly large number of malt whiskies, maybe 45 different whiskies in a typical bottle of, say, Ballantine's or Johnnie Walker. And those 45 different malt whiskies are blended together to try to give a roundness of flavour that'll keep everybody happy. And they occupy about 40% of the liquid in the bottle. The other 60% of the liquid in the bottle is a lighter-tasting grain whiskey, which may be made from barley malt or unmalted barley or wheat or any grain that they choose, and is really a sort of filler. It's still quite tasty, but it is a sort of filler. Now, some of those products are, well, all of those products are all very fine products. But supposing you're drinking your glass of Chivas and you're thinking, well, there's something in here from the Highlands and there's something from the Lowlands and there's something from the Islands. I wonder what those whiskies would taste like on their own. Well, the way to find that out is to sample some of the single malts. It's the difference between listening to an orchestra and listening to a soloist. The single malt's a soloist.
I don't know how much you're into the folklore surrounding different drinks, but I'm thinking if you think you got a chill today or you're coming down with a cold or something, you're not going to go pour yourself a glass of wine or even have a beer. You'll pour yourself a shot of scotch.
I did once read a remedy. It was written by a Frenchman, of course, that if you had wine, about a pint of Burgundy a day would be very good for you. If you had a cold, a pint of Burgundy a day would be very good for you. Don't take that terribly seriously.
Right.
But, Scotch certainly gives the appearance of being much more warming, and since it's relatively strong, probably quite antiseptic too. I'm sticking to that belief anyway.
Some people say that you won't get as hungover with Scotch as you will with beer or wine. What's your experience?
My experience, I regret to say, is to the contrary. I have a very definite belief about hangovers. Which is essentially that the blander the product is, the less likely you are to get a hangover from it, and the fuller in flavour it is, not fuller in body, but fuller in flavour it is, probably more complex in flavour, probably the greater your chance of getting a hangover. That's all of my experience, and I believe it to be true, and I believe it to be based on the fact that the natural chemical compounds that occur in fine wines, fine beers, single malt scotches that make them complex and interesting, unfortunately, may also give you a hangover if you drink too much of them.
Hmm.
There was some British writer who said he felt sorry for people who didn't wake up with a hangover because that was as good as they were going to feel all day. I just throw that little philosophical thought into our discussion.
Do you get hungover much, or are you such the professional at drinking that you never overdrink?
Well, I very rarely drink too much. That maybe makes me sound like a bit of a party pooper, but when I'm working, I'm drinking to taste these products, so I'm certainly not chugging them. I think we all occasionally go to a dinner party, perhaps, and have rather a lot of wine and maybe have a digestive afterwards and get a hangover. And I do suffer rather... When I do get a hangover, I suffer miserably from hangovers. And there's no real cure. I mean, you can drink a lot of water before you go to bed, but you probably don't remember to do that. The most important thing to do if you have a hangover, really, is to do something about your blood sugar level in the morning. And the best thing to do is to... You really have to eat something. However little you feel like eating something, you really must eat something. You must force yourself to eat something. Something like toast and honey is very good. Or I think my sort of classic Jewish recipe, although it's a Jewish recipe for everything, of course, is chicken soup. But chicken soup is very good for getting rid of a hangover.
Even for breakfast, huh?
Well, depends how late you lay in, I suppose.
How did you get involved with being a professional beer writer, especially given that so few people have focused on beer as compared to wine?
I was originally a newspaper journalist, and
mm-hmm.
I still contribute a lot to newspapers, and I contribute to the food pages of a London paper called The Independent, and occasionally to The Washington Post and to various food and drink magazines. But originally I was a hard news journalist and then a columnist, and for a time a television journalist too. And they all drank beer. Journalists all drank beer. They all loved it. They all talked about it incessantly among themselves. Do you think this one's better than one we had last night? I was on an assignment in such a city, and I had this one, and wow, you should taste that. They were fascinated with beer, yet when it came to the idea of trying to persuade the newspaper or the magazine or the TV station to actually do something about beer, they would say, oh, well, people aren't interested in that.
You mean to cover it?
Yes, though they were all interested in it themselves, they somehow thought that their readers out there had a quite different perception. And I always felt that it was very odd that people loved drinking beer and then went off to write articles about wine. So I was always trying to... I was a sort of guerrilla warrior, even in those days, trying to get stories about beer into the paper. Very often the only way around doing that was to actually ostensibly write about pubs and sort of sneak in the beer information. The pub was the Trojan horse, and you snuck in the beer information inside that Trojan horse. And eventually somebody asked me to write a book on pubs, and really halfway through writing the book, I mean, I accepted the assignment and the book eventually was published and everybody was happy with it, but halfway through I'd realized I really wanted to write a book about beer.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one final question. Are you tired of people making Michael Jackson jokes, you know, about the singer versus you?
Well, I guess if I'm not used to it now, I never will be.
What's your standard comeback on that?
Well, it depends precisely what the joke is, but, you know, I like to point out to people that I had the name first. I've considered writing to the other Michael Jackson saying that for a very small royalty, I'll license my name to him. Otherwise, I'll sue him for stealing my name. I'm a terrible dancer, but I can sing. I think when I sing rather more black people's music than he does, because I'm a lover of the blues, so... I even have a glove, right, which I occasionally use just for a little joke.
Oh, really?
Tasting glove, you know, to put a bit of glitter into my beer.
Well, Michael Jackson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Jackson writes about beer and single malt scotch. His books include The New World Guide to Beer and The Pocket Guide to Beer. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel in Washington. Coming up on All Things Considered, we check back on Joe Haddad, the Iraqi-American soldier who, while he was serving in Saudi Arabia, didn't know what had become of his fiancée in Baghdad. Now she's gotten out and they're together once again. We'll also be hearing about developments in Yugoslavia. Reporter Tom Jelton visits Krajina, a region of Croatia where mostly Serbs live. And on this, our National Independence Day, we'll be listening to some of the national anthems of other countries and talking with music critic Tom Manoff about what makes a national anthem. Those stories coming up on All Things Considered later from National Public Radio.
More barbecues are probably fired up on July 4th than on any other day of the year. Most people consider a meal out of doors on the 4th to be a relaxing experience, but not Ed Ward. Ed is Fresh Air's resident rock and roll historian, but he also writes about books and food.
Sitting in the pile of cookbooks I'll review in the Austin Chronicle at year's end is one by Claudia Roden called Everything Tastes Better Outdoors. I hadn't even noticed this book was there until just recently, but with the onset of hot weather here in Texas, all I can say is, I beg to differ, Claudia. Now, Everything Tastes Better Cooked Outdoors is a concept I can live with, although having worked in the kitchen of a friend's restaurant, I happen to know that that scrumptious grilled flavor is a product of smoke from burning fat coming back at the meat from underneath, not the essence of the great outdoors. What, did you think all those fancy places had a little guy out in the alley with a barbecue cooker? I was even more disappointed to discover that these grilled dishes are often marked on the grill and finished in the oven, and they still taste that way. No, cooking outdoors is one thing, but eating outdoors is quite another. Unfortunately, the 4th of July is one of those traditional picnic days, so a lot of you aren't going to have any choice about this. What I mostly remember about picnics is insects. Let's face it, any insect that can't get at your food while you're sitting on a blanket is probably already extinct. Any insect that can't get at it on a picnic table deserves to become extinct. And picnic insects are serious critters. Yellow jackets, wasps, scorpions, and, down here in Texas, the ever-popular fire ant, who'll bite you and leave a welt the size of a penny, which feels like somebody's put a cigarette out in it. And then there's the menu. Although Claudia Roden's got a whole raft of prepared-ahead cold dishes in her book, as well as various Indian, Chinese, and Middle Eastern charcoal grill recipes, you know as well as I do that today you're going to be eating hamburgers, hot dogs, potato salad, and watermelon. Or maybe somebody will try to barbecue chicken. That's always popular. And although I'm pretty well known among my friends as a good cook, I must admit that when it comes to a meal like this, I'm a complete failure. Well, not complete. I make a great potato salad with green chilies. But hamburgers? Can't make them to save my life. If I can get the meat patties to cohere at all, you can count on their falling apart the minute they're turned, usually into small enough pieces to slip through the grill and frustrate the dog. I wish I could make them. I love charcoal-grilled hamburgers, and I could even get good rolls, brush them with herb-scented olive oil, and grill them, too. So, no hamburgers. Hot dogs, I think you lose affection for when you grow up, but at least any moron can throw them on the grill, and I assume most of you are smart enough to place them at right angles to the grill so they don't fall through, too. As for barbecued chicken, once again, here's a notable failure of mine. There's just something about the fire I don't seem to get. The skin always comes off in one crackly mouthful, leaving pinkish, wet, twangy meat with the consistency of rubber bands underneath. Watermelon comes along on these affairs due to its being naturally insulated. You're not going to be able to keep ice cream cold enough, but the thick rind of a watermelon keeps it cool. Trouble is, it's the dullest member of a great family of fruit. Virtually no taste, and tons of seeds, which don't even sit in the middle of the fruit like they do in most melons. Let's not even talk about watermelon rind pickles, either. Whoever invented them must have been desperate. You can, however, slice watermelon, put them cut side up on a hot fire, and evaporate the flesh, using the so-called watermelon sugar that remains as the basis for a killer barbecue sauce. You still have to sift the seeds out, though. I have no idea what or where I'm going to eat this 4th. If it's at somebody else's house, I'll be gracious and take what I'm served. Food prepared by other people always tastes good. But if I'm home, I suspect that in the interest of eating well, it won't be an all-American feast, and it will be indoors.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, Sue Weinstein, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, turning actors into zombies. We talk with Tom Savini, the special effects makeup whiz, who worked with director George Romero on such films as Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. Also, a talk with actress, novelist, and wit Carrie Fisher. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Final program this season on this station.
Music at Marlborough, Sunday morning at 10 o'clock here on 91 FM, WHYY FM in Philadelphia.